The following program is produced and distributed by KETR.org. You can help by visiting KETR.org and clicking donate.
On May 15, 2010, the Hunt County Sheriff's Office received a phone call from a young woman named Brandy. She was 24, only a year older than her mom, Carrie Mae Parker, when she went missing in early 1991 from Quinlan, Texas. But this was the first time, at least according to Hunt County's timeline, that anyone reported Carrie missing to them. The family understood this. They had just spent months trying to figure out why Carrie wasn't in any missing person database. It turned out that the Hunt County constable who took the original missing person report didn't pass it along to the appropriate authorities for reasons that still aren't clear 26 years later. When Brandy's aunt Patricia discovered that no missing person report was on file, Brandy's the one who got on the phone with the sheriff's office and filed one herself. Finally, they all thought, law enforcement was going to begin the hard work that would be required to discover what happened to Carrie. At that time, everyone in the family wanted to help. They provided names of the people Carrie knew and offered to put investigators in touch with Carrie's father. But that never happened. And by 2013, nearly 3 years after trying to file a missing person report for a third time, Brandy's Aunt Patricia sent Sheriff Randy Meeks this desperate message. How are we going into the third year in detective mode, and absolutely no communication, no interviews, no nothing? I just don't understand why, at least since 2010, there's been no movement. She was a person. She was someone who had kids. The youngest one was two. She was someone who was stolen from us. I'm asking you to please look into what is going on and communicate with us. The next Monday, January 7th, 2013, 22 years after Carrie was last seen alive, and almost 3 years after the family turned to his office for help, Sheriff Meeks replied, "This is the very first that I've heard of this." From KETR Public Radio in Northeast Texas, this is Buried, an investigative series and podcast about the disappearance of Carrie Mae Parker and why so little is known nearly three decades later. In this episode, we're going to find out what was going on at the sheriff's office in the nearly 3 years that passed before Sheriff Meeks found out about Carrie's disappearance. We're going to learn about a controversial technique called forensic hypnosis and how it was used in an attempt to intimidate a member of Carrie's family with the apparent approval of the sheriff. We're also going to try and find out what happened to two separate DNA samples submitted by Carrie's sisters in a bid to identify possible remains. And we're going to do all of this on our own, because the sheriff's office won't talk to us. For this reason, we're going to go to the next best thing to tell their side of the story. Dozens of emails and documents about the case that KETR obtained in the process of making this podcast. But before we get to that, we're going to check in with Glenn, Carrie's older brother, who encountered a mysterious hitchhiker not long before Brandy filed her missing person report. The woman's name is Stacy, a drug dealer who knew Carrie and her ex-boyfriend Cody. According to Carrie's father, Howard, Carrie mentioned Cody digging a large hole on his property shortly before she came up missing. No one knew exactly what she meant or if it had any connection to her disappearance. They also didn't know with certainty what property of Cody's she was talking about. They all knew that Cody's dad, Jim Songer, owned a septic business on the state highway that also constitutes Main Street in Quinlan. Here's Glenn explaining what happened when he encountered Stacy nearly 20 years later.
She used to hang around Carrie and Cody back in the day, and I didn't never know her real well. I'd seen her from time to time, and we were talking about Carrie, and I don't think she really realized that I was Carrie's brother, that maybe I was a friend. But I gave her a ride and said, "Do you want to know where Carrie Parker is?" I said, "Yes." She said, turn down 34, said, "Go past the police station." Went past the police station, and Lord and behold, whose place did she pick out? The old Songer place.
Glenn and his sister Patricia don't agree on the exact spot that she meant, and the property has changed hands since 1991. There's an adjacent lot that's vacant, but was also used by a company leasing the property until about 10 years ago. That's the lot Glenn thinks Stacy was pointing toward that day, although it isn't technically the same property. At one spot, dirt is piled high near the highway, on the other side of a relatively new fence now separating the properties.
Said that more or less Cody had said something in front of her one time or the other, something about Carrie and what happened to her, but she never really was able to get anywhere with it, because it's just hearsay word of mouth, and these people, Hunt County down here, I don't know if they're protecting a lot of the dealers down here. Stacy, the one that showed me the place, she's a dealer. As a matter of fact, the last time I heard, she was in prison. I don't know if she got out, but she was a pretty big dealer here back in the time. She never was a bad person. You know, that day that she told me that, that was all that she was saying. She clammed up after that. Almost like she don't want to say something. I got the impression that if she did, it would put her in jeopardy. But the thing is, why would a woman say something like that out of the blue when we didn't really even suspect Cody in the first place?
Yeah.
And it's funny, now whether they've sold it to this day or not, I really don't think so, because really ain't nothing changed on it.
Except
maybe the dirt and stuff. But if there's any merit to that woman's story, even the fact that Carrie and him were having problems. And see, his mama was very protective. Cody was her baby. She was kind of scary. And the Saunders were some scary people, as I heard later down the line. I mean, I was always cool with them, so I guess I never did get to see that side of them. But if they had access to a backhoe, and they could have got rid of the car and all, and if it'd be my guess, that would be where she is. You can't dig through stone, and you have to have equipment to move it. So you're not accidentally going to find her. Is there any more questions you got?
These are the letters, by the way, for the woman in prison.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I ain't never seen them. Because Patty ain't show me. She would never tell me any more information. She shut up. She just tell me where she was. If they could get somebody to go in the Saunders place and search all three spots, including the one with that dirt back there, with the rocks underneath the dirt.
Yeah.
See, they keep dirt. They sell field dirt and rock and stuff like that still. I noticed they store it there. For a while, there was just the concrete with a little bit of dirt on top, and the grass grows, and they built the fence in between. Right after, my sister started advertising it in the newspapers and stuff like that. All of a sudden, they built a fence right there.
Yeah.
And that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
But how can you sell all them other places, but you ain't going to see it sell there, and it's never been nothing but a dirt and rock storage place, and you got all this concrete on your property, ruining the value of your property. Why? Because maybe the car and hers under there.
In 2012, Patricia tracked Stacy down in prison and started writing to her. I have the original letters in a safety deposit box. Here's part of the first one from Patricia. Although you don't know me, I am pleading on behalf of myself and my family to ask if you would tell us what you know. At least give her kids a chance to move forward and cope with the loss of their mother. You have no idea how much this information could heal a hurting family. Stacy wrote back right away, offering to help as much as she could. One thing she noted was that she didn't know with certainty if Carrie was buried on the property, just that she has reason to suspect it. But that's not how Glenn recalls the conversation.
What she told me, she was there.
Okay, that makes a difference.
She didn't say, maybe, or I think. She pointed over me and said, she's right there. That cement was not there before her disappearance. Then all of a sudden, a very short time later, within 6 months, I really don't know, because it took me a little while to notice that they were gone. But after Carrie's disappearance, they moved right away.
In December 2012, Stacy drew a map from the perspective of someone standing on the state highway and facing the property. She even drew an arrow to a spot at the back corner where they kept equipment. She added the note, "I'm thinking here." I brought this map to Glenn's house so he could tell me how similar the layout was. His reaction?
Holy crap! You remember where I was telling you where I thought she was buried? Right there.
Yeah.
I'm thinking here.
Yeah.
This is the scrapyard now.
Yeah.
You have a building here. This part here never got sold. They just recently, as my sister come out with that crap in the paper, put a fence right here, metal fence, where you can't see in it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've seen that.
Okay, for a long time there was a hump right next to this fence,
really?
About that high. Now, if you put something, you take dirt out of a hole, you fill it up, and you put the dirt back, you're gonna have extra dirt. All of a sudden, they went out there right after she come out with all that, and that hump disappeared. They leveled it, then built that fence.
Stacy's recollection of the property was identical to satellite images from the time period. That obviously doesn't prove anything, but there's many more strange connections to this property that we'll get to later. But the important part is that the place Glenn remembers Stacy knowing about was the Songer property and its immediate neighbor. And Stacy, in letters from prison in 2012 and 2013, confirmed that's the same property she meant. She's also offered to discuss the case with detectives, but I'm not aware of any attempt by law enforcement to reach her since then. The sheriff's office also hasn't interviewed Glenn, despite Patricia's urging. It seems like a missed opportunity.
But, you know, it's awful funny, too, that if part of it ain't truth, how come Hunt County ain't wanting to do nothing? They have never done no investigation over my sister.
Yeah.
And who's the first person? You're going to know what they are, because who's the first people to go and come to? The family.
Yeah, you would know.
Because family members or boyfriends or husbands are the first people they're going to look at.
Yeah.
Then once they roll you out, then they may go somewhere else. I've never been questioned.
Yeah.
We've never really got past day one. Why is that? Because you're covering some of your own back doorstep?
But Glenn remembers the last time he saw the Hunt County Constable and what happened when he asked about his sister.
Colton Smith, a couple years before he passed away, when he was still in office up there, we got to talking about it, and I got to talking to him about what that girl said about where Carrie was buried.
Yeah.
Well, he got me to come to see me to talk to me, and he wanted me to actually get in the car and take him there. And I'm taking myself, well, you know where Cody's place is.
Yeah.
You know where Jim Songer's place is. Matter of fact, you work right down the street. And back in them days, you know, I still hung around a lot of people in the dope world and stuff. And you're like, you're not getting me in front seat of a car, and somebody in town sees me in that car, I'm going to end up just like them.
Yeah.
And that's when he warned about watch what I say to anybody else. Yes, sir. He said, don't talk to anybody else in this system.
In the police system?
Yes, in Quinlan.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Why?
He said, some of the people that were working there then are still there, and it could mean your life. I think Daddy was pretty close. That may have been where Daddy was getting some of his information from. And he told me, point blank, don't talk to anybody else. You might not live long. I've come to terms that I'm not going to get the police down here to do that much about it. I can't bring her back. I don't have the money to pull the strings that needs to be pulled. And Vince, this is a high-profile area for drugs and stuff like that. There's just, what I used to say, there's a monster down here, and it ain't a man. And I used to wonder what that meant. Until one time I got too high. When I was back on it, I found out what that meant.
What's that?
Everybody around here protects each other. And if you're a threat, you're gone.
I met Carrie's sister, Patricia, before Glenn, and I didn't know at the time that he lived in the same neighborhood where Carrie grew up. It's a short drive from Greenville, where the Hunt County Sheriff's Office is based.
The cops need to talk to my brother about some of his stuff that he knows.
Yeah. Where's your brother,
brother? He's in Waco Bay over there by where Pops used to live.
Good,
yeah. But he'll talk.
Yeah.
Patricia told me about how she first contacted Stacy after hearing from Glenn, even though the idea scared her a little bit.
So he was hitchhiking that day and picked her up, and they were, I don't know how they got on the subject of Carrie or anything, but...
I'm sure as soon as somebody said this. But this is your brother?
Yeah, okay, this is my brother.
Glenn, yeah.
Yeah, and he said that they drove by on 276 out of Quinlan there by that property, and as soon as they came up on the property, you want to know where your sister is? And pointed to where the area is, and that's how come I looked her up and found out where she was and started communicating with her. I never really went as far as going to the Marlin, because she was just here in Marlin, and I had really good intentions of going to see her, but she was heavy into drugs, and those all them people still now she communicates with them.
Yeah.
I didn't really want her to see, like, I didn't know how far I wanted to go.
Yeah. Well,
just me anyways, you know, doing this. Her name was on my list of people.
What list?
Of people that I had. I have lists here. One person would lead to another person, or a brother, or sister, or somebody, any kind of connection.
But you didn't have any reason to believe that.
Well, the reason why I picked her is because my brother said that one day he was cruising along down 34.
Hitchhiker.
Right?
Yes.
And picked her up. And they had a conversation. I don't know how she figured out who he was or any of that kind of stuff. You know, that's why I'm telling.
Carrie had stayed on the property with Cody when they were together. Patricia told me about what happened after Carrie went missing, and I verified this through property tax records. The septic company moved to a different county not long after Carrie disappeared. But the owners held on to a very small part of the property for several years. So it seemed like a pretty big deal when she heard about Stacy.
The property.
Yes,
oh, my brother,
out.
My brother, yes, and that's why I went to her, and Google is my friend,
yeah.
And found her. I found her number and everything. You know, they give you a number when you go to prison or jail or whatever,
oh,
so
right.
I found all that mess, and when she's supposed to be released, and it'll tell you on there what she's in jail for. All her jail stuff is for methamphetamines.
Yeah.
Someone had to tell her, and I'll tell you why. It's because when Carrie came up missing, and I verified it, Stacy was in jail.
Mm-hmm.
So when Stacy got out, she goes back to all these drug dealers and stuff that knows Carrie and Cody and everybody, and you know, the cat got out the bag.
Yeah.
Patricia had a pretty similar reaction to Glenn's when she saw Stacy's map, drawn from memory in prison. She remembered where Cody lived and where the business buildings were located. But Patricia ran into trouble after contacting the new owners. We haven't had much luck either. That's going to happen a lot. But the property has been on law enforcement's radar since at least 2008. In one case, verified by a landowner and an email from a detective, deputies visited the property and looked for justification for a warrant. The owners haven't cooperated with anyone other than law enforcement, which makes sense. However, when Patricia first contacted her, she sought permission to run ground-penetrating sonar, not to dig up the ground.
So I kind of wonder what they know. There's something in there. There's something in there that's not right. Why would you do this? If I told you, or if someone told me, hey, I think there's a body buried out there on your property right over there. can I go over there and look at it and, you know, do a search or whatever and see if we find anything? I'm going to tell you, hell yeah. Something ain't right with that property, and I don't know what it is unless she's there.
In the fall of 2012, Brandy and Patricia sought help from the Department of Public Safety and the Texas Rangers. Immediately, a Texas Ranger named Courtney Fowler noticed an oversight. Carrie's case wasn't in the state's missing person clearinghouse. That's the most basic step for registering a missing person. It's a central database of every missing person in the state. If someone's found dead, they can look them up in the registry and inform the local department. But if the name isn't there and the body can't be identified, it remains unknown. She also noticed that no DNA was on file from Carrie's relatives, and she asked for family members to submit a sample of their saliva at the Hunt County Sheriff's Office. This is also standard practice for cases this old. It's also another vital step for identifying human remains. Carrie's body could have been found long ago. A DNA match would instantly identify her and resolve the case. But no one from Hunt County asked for a sample until the ranger got involved, and Carrie's family didn't know they were supposed to do that. So Patricia and her younger sister Mary traveled to Greenville to submit their samples.
So we went down there. I went down there. It was the end of 2012, it seems like. It was close to Thanksgiving. Yes. And I went and gave mine. And Mary went and gave hers 2 weeks after I did. Okay. We both gave them to two separate people in the department.
Then they sprung into action and...
lost it. Yeah, I can't find your shit. What? Excuse me? How much more can you screw up on a case?
What followed was a mind-numbing, months-long saga of lost DNA and misunderstandings. I had to draw the timeline on a wall to get my head around it. But here's the short version. Brandy contacted the Rangers in fall 2012, and they responded asking her to fill out paperwork to list Carrie in the missing persons clearinghouse in October. Both sisters submitted DNA samples the next month, and the Ranger, Courtney Fowler, asked the family to get more samples from Carrie's dad and children. Mary, Carrie's youngest sister, said that the detective broke appointments to meet with her father in a nursing home, and eventually acknowledged that the office lost at least Mary's DNA sample. Patricia inquired with the Ranger, who in turn asked for an update in Fort Worth at the receiving lab. They hadn't received anything either at the start of the next year, 2013. After the confusion in Hunt County, the Ranger encouraged Carrie's family to submit samples to their own police in separate counties. But there was a hitch. They needed permission from the Hunt County detective. I requested records from Patricia's police station in Central Texas confirming that they took her sample there in April 2013.
It took me 9 months of working and waiting on the DPS to get with Hunt County because they would never answer any phones. Well, imagine that, and all this other stuff, you know, to let them be aware that we're going to do this locally at our own police department.
I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah. And here's where I gave mine.
And that's all it took.
That's it. And they did it by the book. Nothing like they did in Hunt County. I really feel sorry for them people that get sentenced in that county because of the way that they operate.
It's interesting.
I mean, seriously.
You know,
he wore gloves, but I didn't sign no document like I signed with this man right here. They didn't sit here and put a piece. Well, he put a piece of tape on the box, but then what happened to it after that? How do you lose someone's, two people's DNA?
But it's not like people are coming in every day saying,
ask,
like, you know,
hey, look, man, take my shit. You know, I mean, really. You know, is it up to the family to do this, or is this not a police thing to do?
After the DNA episode in January 2013, Patricia contacted Randy Meeks, the sheriff, in exasperation. Meeks seemed genuinely concerned about how this slipped past him. Here's part of what he wrote. I guess two questions I have are, why wasn't she reported missing right away back in 1991? And why someone hasn't contacted me before 2 years have gone by, and no word on this case from anyone? On a case such as this, we consider this a priority case. I can't imagine any of my investigators not at least giving someone from the family a phone call. I assure you that I will check into that, and I will let you know if we failed on our end. I am very sorry about your sister, and I promise you that we will look into her disappearance. The new detective's name is Jeff Haynes. It appears from emails sent to the family that he approved the DNA samples to be taken elsewhere. He also located Patricia's original sample, which was passed along in March. Despite this encouraging start, relations quickly went south. In spring 2014, when Patricia traveled up to the sheriff's office on the way to get some paperwork for her dad, Haynes pulled her into an impromptu interrogation. In that moment, Patricia officially became the first person we know of to ever be questioned about her sister's disappearance. During the conversation, Haynes asked her if she was at the station because she felt guilty about something. Patricia told me the conversation scarred her so badly that she started taking anti-anxiety medication as a result. It's not directly related, but one time I got dragged into a surprise interrogation while reporting this story. Relations with the sheriff's office didn't improve as a result.
And if I had anything to do with it, why would I, here, take it? Take it? Why not just say, hey, I did something? I just don't.
But they don't think you're a suspect or anything, do they?
I don't know if they do or not, and frankly, I don't care, because I know what I know.
But the only thing they've ever said to you is that one weird comment.
Just that one weird comment in that interview.
But do you think they could have meant you felt guilty that you got into an argument and you left the house?
No, because I didn't. I don't think that I told them about our ordeal with my ordeal with Carrie.
Yeah.
The subject just didn't come up. And I was in there for a whole 2 hours or so.
Yeah.
Crying.
Sure.
It was the most. Ooh. And I understand that police have to talk to family members, but when you're only talking to one, you miss my dad, you miss my brother, you miss my younger sister, you know, you miss the ex-boyfriend, and you just taking mine, you know, how am I supposed to feel?
But things turned really ugly after Patricia refused Haynes' request to submit to a controversial investigative practice that made her uncomfortable. It's called forensic hypnosis, a tool to supposedly help people recall memories from their past. Haynes argued that because Carrie's case was so old, maybe Patricia could remember something important if she underwent hypnosis. She eventually agreed, but changed her mind at the urging of her family. That September, as relations soured more than ever, Haynes sent Patricia an email that shocked me the first time I read it, and I still find it hard to comprehend. Haynes wrote that if Patricia didn't agree to be hypnotized, he'd essentially call off the search for her sister. He wrote that forensic hypnosis was, quote, a viable option that you specifically chose not to pursue on this matter. The fact remains that until all avenues are explored on this angle of the investigation, resources can't and won't be provided until I receive your full and undivided cooperation. I have forwarded this to Sheriff Meeks, who has been kept fully up to date on this investigation. Regretfully, Sergeant Jeff Haynes. And Sheriff Meeks was CC'd on the email. I asked the Texas Rangers to make someone available to explain forensic hypnosis and when it's appropriate to use, but they declined. Of course, I would have also asked Detective Haynes and Sheriff Meeks about it had they agreed to speak to me. University of Texas at Austin cognitive psychologist Arthur Markman gave me an overview of the practice. He's not a fan of forensic hypnosis in general, so he was unlikely to approve of hypnotizing Patricia in the first place, but he also questioned the point of using hypnosis in this specific case, and someone unlikely to have memories that might lead to physical evidence. We spoke by phone.
I think a lot of people have a general misunderstanding of what hypnosis is, that comes from, you watch old cartoons, and somebody hypnotizes you and suddenly you're in this altered state in which, you're not functioning under your own control anymore. And, I think what we recognize is that hypnosis is basically a way of trying to relax people in ways that might make them more willing to go along with suggestions that you make to them. In some sense, if I'm sitting at the dinner table and I say to you, will you please pass the salt? And then you pass me the salt. You are accepting my request, and you do that because you don't see any downside to doing that, and so nothing stops you from doing that. But if I asked you to do something ridiculous, you might say, "Well, no, I'm not going to do that because I'm engaging all of these brain mechanisms that stop me from complying with your request. And what hypnosis does is to try to put you in a relaxed enough state that you're unlikely to engage those mechanisms that will stop you from doing something. Now, the problem is that when it comes to memory and memory retrieval and things like that, there isn't a single source of memory in the brain where you reach into a file and pull out the particular memory for an event and then read that out. And the reason that matters is because whenever we recall an event from the past in memory, we are actually integrating information across many different parts of that situation, as well as things that we may have thought about since the original event occurred that may become part of that memory. And the only thing that keeps us from putting too much of what's happened in the interim into our memory is our ability to reason a little bit and think about what's called source memory, which is the source of information that we've encountered. If you relax somebody enough so that they're not really thinking very critically about what they remember, they are prone to incorporate all kinds of information into what they retrieve, some of which is a memory of an earlier event, but some of which may be things that happened to them much later, and they're not going to do the same level of scrutiny of their knowledge about the source of that information. And as a result, you can end up pulling together all sorts of information from the past into what now feels like a single unified event. And worse yet, that experience of going through the hypnosis then becomes an event in your life that doesn't have a lot of source markings to it, because you're in such a relaxed state, you're not really thinking about the situation in which you encountered that, which means it can then create what feels like a more solid memory of the past just as a result of having gone through the hypnosis, even though that isn't necessarily giving you a true picture of what happened before. The detectives are hoping that there's some detail that she recalls that they might then be able to go get physical evidence for. Then it seems to me reasonable to try some technique that might help somebody remember a small detail that could then be corroborated with physical evidence. But I would be very reluctant to want to see someone convicted on the basis of eyewitness testimony that involved that kind of a technique.
Markman also explained how using hypnosis on someone as close to the presumed victim could make the case hard to prosecute.
People have talked about trying to do that, but I guess hypnosis is not going to provide a clearer window into prior memories than what you get out of just someone trying to recall something from the past. It is the case that if you are being less critical in your thinking while you're retrieving things, you might end up pushing together lots of different sources of things that are in your head, some of which might be actual events that occurred, some of which might be things you've thought about or dreamed about, the fact that something may come out of an interview and someone may create a coherent memory 19 years after some event doesn't mean that that's a clear picture into what actually happened there. It means that you've given someone an opportunity to reconstruct some belief about the past that includes all sorts of things that may have happened to them in the intervening years. So it's not obvious what value this is going to create. I mean, it certainly doesn't seem to me to create something that would be something I would want to go to court with.
Well, I can understand why they would have a lot of hostility. It seems like everything related to my mother towards them has been really negative.
With all the chaos and accusations surrounding the case, it's easy to understand why certain family members have pulled away. One of them is Carrie's second child, Brandy, who I met in North Texas at her home. Brandy is 31 and looks a lot like her mother, more than anyone I've met so far. Brandy's also got the coolest head of everyone involved, the usual adult in the room. She's direct and doesn't make assumptions about anything. I often fact-check certain things I hear with her, knowing that she'll look for the most likely answer. For that reason, Brandy was a great asset before 2014, when she and Patricia worked together on keeping the detectives in line. We wouldn't even know Carrie's missing person report went missing itself if it wasn't for her asking the right questions. But when the dispute between Patricia and the sheriff's office spilled into social media and local newspapers, Brandy decided to focus more on her children than the drama of this investigation. This was one of the first things she told me, how much she wished her mom's name wasn't linked to antagonism toward the investigators handling her case. And she thinks Patricia treated the sheriff, in particular, too harshly.
So, well, she was in a lot of email, a lot of those emails, so some of it maybe. Yeah.
But,
yeah, I mean, he's human. He's going to respond just the way you would expect humans to respond, whether or not it's professional. I mean, you got to keep in mind that you're dealing with people here. You can't just treat them however you want to and expect to get the job done. I mean, you catch more flies with honey. That's a saying for a reason.
Yeah.
Patty put a lot of stuff out there on social media to make it as visible as possible. It became visible. They couldn't ignore it anymore. She was recruiting people to contact them, send emails, make phone calls. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think that it was helpful. It was necessary because obviously they did something after that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's what it was.
Brandy and Patricia have vastly different opinions about how to approach people. And I'm speaking from personal experience. But they don't view what happened before 2013 very differently. It was Brandy who contacted the DPS and Rangers to intervene, for example.
I worked with somebody at the Texas DPS because the Hunt County was not, in any of our opinions, doing anything to help us. They did say that they would assist in the investigation.
Yeah.
So I don't really agree with the way Hunt County has been defamed, the things that have been said about them, because I know that it was a very hard case. I mean, they didn't even know. There was no missing persons report until 2010. It's not like they had anything to go on. They're in a very difficult position, and I know that they did a lot. I don't know exactly what they did. I think in the beginning there were a lot of things that were mishandled. For instance, Texas law has very specific requirements about law enforcement's responsibilities when a person is reported missing. My mother wasn't entered into the missing persons clearinghouse until 2012, and I had to initiate that. And it took me, like, I didn't understand why my mother's missing persons case didn't look like every other missing case. Where's her missing persons poster? Where's the outreach? Where's all of that stuff? Like the face on the milk carton. I know they don't do anything like that, but you kind of get like the sentiment that I'm talking about. None of that happened. And I had to, me as the daughter of some of the person that's missing, I had to do all of the legwork. I had to do the research to determine what the laws were. I had to do the research to figure out how to get her into the database, when in actuality, it was the police department's responsibility to explain that to me and to help me get it done. And that never happened. And that, I think that's my biggest frustration with how it was handled, is there's a lot of misconceptions about what happens when somebody's missing, who's supposed to do what, and it shouldn't be so hard for the family.
One thing that really gets under her skin is the sheriff's office's claim over the years that people are unreachable and can't be found.
A lot of the pushback that we got in the beginning of the investigation is, you're giving us all of these names. We don't know how to track down these people. Okay, this is law enforcement. You have a certain level of expectation that they have the capabilities to do these things. Like it shouldn't be on us to try to track down these people for them. For a while there, it felt like Patty and I were doing their job.
She reminded me of what I'd read about the detective shutting down the investigation until one person does what he wants. I read Brandy the email from Haynes explaining that Patricia's unwillingness to undergo hypnosis was holding up the case.
I don't understand what they would expect, even if it is a valid investigative technique. I don't understand what they would expect to get gained from her, since she wasn't even, I don't think that she even lived in the area. I think she lived in Houston when my mom disappeared. So that's not going to help them at all. And I think that she told them that. I may not be like at their doorstep hounding them every step of the way and harassing them, but you know, she still has, Carrie still has family that, that loved her and care for what the outcome is. And I don't have any hope anymore at this point of ever having answers or ever finding her. But at the same time, don't dismiss the entire family because one person isn't doing what you want them to.
To me, the most infuriating part of the whole hypnosis issue is that it delayed and eventually prevented anyone from interviewing Howard Parker, Carrie's father and Brandy's grandfather. I would kill for the chance to talk to this guy. The things Howard told his children and grandchildren over the years about Carrie's disappearance are shocking. I also wish I had the chance to ask about some of the things I've heard about him.
It's a really big chance.
And we told them, like we told them several times, he's sick. He's getting dementia. You guys need to go out there now. And they just waited until his dementia was so far gone that he couldn't even tell you that there weren't alligators in the room. So,
like, but sorry, did they actually ever agree to interview him or ever try?
Okay. No. We were telling them from the very beginning, hey, he's sick. You need to get out there as soon as you can.
Do you know, happen to remember what his condition was like around this time, September 2014? It's very specific.
It was bad. He was bad for a number of years. As far as his dementia, by that point, he was still having lucid periods. I think his lucid periods and his dementia periods were about 50-50. But if you sat around long enough, you would catch a lucid period at that point. Okay. And if they had gone in 2010 or 2011 and initiated the investigation immediately, like Texas law says they were supposed to do, he would have been completely lucid the entire time. And he would have talked to them. Yeah. He would have talked to you if he was still alive.
Howard died in 2015, taking any knowledge he had to the grave, while Patricia and the sheriff's office argued about hypnosis. The next year, in 2016, Sheriff Meeks confirmed his knowledge of the hypnosis issue. In one of the most surreal moments of the entire episode, Patricia and Sheriff Meeks started posting insults about each other on Facebook. "I have nothing nice to say about Meeks, so I will just leave it at that," Patricia wrote. Meeks responded, "I don't usually respond to attacks such as yours. However, you know as well as I do that your refusal to submit to forensic hypnotics has stalled the investigation. Let's put the facts out there. Please come in and do your part instead of blaming us for nothing being done." The episode was straight out of high school, and I wouldn't usually mention it, but there's a really important reason I'm bringing it up. A file from the sheriff's office stating that the investigator assigned to the case ruled Patricia out as a candidate for hypnosis several years before Meek's Facebook posts. Remember the anti-anxiety medication I mentioned earlier from 2014? In a sheriff's office document about Carrie's case, Haynes notes that Patricia, quote, indicated that she had been diagnosed with depression and on medication for the depression. Subsequently, I didn't pursue the forensic hypnosis any further, knowing that this diagnosis and medication eliminated her as a candidate. I don't know why the sheriff would blame one of Carrie's siblings for something his own office determined she was ineligible to do. If he isn't familiar with the case, I think that would speak to what the family has been saying all along. If he knows she's ineligible and posting it on Facebook anyway, that's sort of a different story. I won't pretend I know the answer, but I do think the MO is important to keep in mind as we move forward. There's a second document, though, that gave me pause and made me question what I've read and been told about the Parkers' cooperativeness. It's a short note attached to the original 2010 missing person report. It's at the bottom of the page on the internal description of Brandy's call. I think of it as minute one of the Hunt County Sheriff's Office's investigation into Carrie Mae Parker's disappearance, and I wonder how much it reflects the attitudes of the people looking for her. It reads, quote, "She's been missing for 19 years, and daughter wants to try to find her," followed by 3 exclamation points.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's been 19 years. Yeah, but I'm just now finding out that my mother's, that there was never a missing persons report. The first moment is, let's not take her seriously. Yeah. And that's how I felt about it whenever.
I hesitated to even show this to Brandy, but I think she would show me if the roles were reversed and if they were talking about my mom. I'm not sure if I'd stay as composed as she did, though, but I'm also not used to this sort of thing.
No, I appreciate it. It kind of confirms. I mean, if my aunt saw that, I imagine, yeah, that kind of, I just need to take some deep breaths, sleep on it, and kind of try to rationalize it before I react. No, it's very shady. That's the conclusion that I've reached so far, is they're, I feel like they're hiding something, and that just confirms that it's not serious for them. Because I know they're not taking the investigation seriously, and I would not be surprised if they have some notes somewhere in their documents about how uncooperative or pushy. I would expect some kind of unprofessional documentation, and I don't... She was a human life.
Exactly.
Whether she was a drug addict who didn't contribute to anything to society or not, she was a human life. She deserved more than that attitude.
Buried is produced by Emma Anderson and me. Its executive producer is Jared Knight. Theme music composed by Brad Davis. Photography is by Brittany Greider. Cover art is from Crystal Sid. Special thanks to Chris H. and WD. Buried is a production of member-supported 88.9 KETR FM in Commerce, Texas. To support this and other programming, go to KETR.org.
This show and others like it from KETR.org are made possible by generous contributions from listeners just like you. Donate today at KETR.org.